Auhea o ko e ko ka aha, inahe kuleana i mua o kea, aha ho o kolo kolo ki e ke hanohano, o ka moku aina o Hawaii. E nai mai, e malio mai, i lohi ia ka leo. Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye, all persons having any business before this Honorable Supreme Court of the State of Hawaii, draw nigh. Give your attention and you shall be heard. E noho I lalo, please be seated.
Please call the case.
Case number SCWC22585, Alpha Inc., petitioner and respondent appellant versus Board of Water Supply, City and County of Honolulu, respondent and petitioner appellee, and Office of Administrative Hearings, Department of Commerce and Consumer Affairs, State of Hawaii, respondent appellee, and Baylek Energetic AJV, respondent appellee, intervener appellee. Arguing for the petitioner, Alpha Inc., Jeffrey Osterkamp, also appearing, Kirk Nesty. Arguing for the respondent, Board of Water Supply, City and County of Honolulu, Joseph Stewart. Also appearing, Stephen Kaneshiro. Appearing for Baylek Energetic AJV, Lyle Hosoda and Spencer Lau. Argument on the merits.
All right. Good morning. Aloha, everyone. Sorry we're a bit delayed in getting started, but we're looking forward to our arguments today, which are being broadcast live on our YouTube channel as well as on Alelo. Council, are you both ready to proceed? All right, we have 30 minutes for each side, 1 hour total. Mr. Osterkamp, you've asked for a warning when we get 20 minutes into your initial argument and then keep 10 minutes for rebuttal. So with that, please proceed. Oh, yes, please.
As noted, I have here today with me my co-counsel, Kirk Nesty, and I'd also like to mention that we have the summer associate here, Christopher Rutsch, who helped quite a bit on this case, and the COO of Alpha Inc., Mr. Greg Sato, is in the audience as well.
Thank you.
So, Mr. Chief Justice, Associate Justices, may it please the court. I'm here today on behalf of Alpha, which is a locally owned and operated construction company, to discuss two broad issues. First, to show that the Intermediate Court of Appeals erred by affirming a determination that a bid Alpha submitted for a project to install three wells on Central Oahu was non-responsive to the solicitation and thus invalid. Secondly, and this will presumably be mostly on rebuttal, I'll address the Board of Water Supply's interpretation of the Hawaii Public Procurement Code, which would effectively allow agencies to avoid accountability and award public projects based on their own criteria rather than the procurement code's requirements. Now, a theme that is highly relevant to both issues is the basic purpose of the procurement code.
Increase the volume just a bit and maybe pull the mic a little bit, just a bit. Thank you.
Does that work better?
Yeah, it's better. Yeah.
Thank you. So it's been some time since the Hawaii Supreme Court has addressed the public procurement code in any detail. I'm sure the justices are aware of the two Carl Corp cases from 1997 and 2001. We believe that it's high time for the court to address certain aspects of the procurement code once again. But what we have relating to both issues in this case is that, as we know, absent the procurement code, the state and its counties could handle the billions of dollars in public procurement work without a procurement code at all, if that were the legislature's desire. Agencies could bid things out like public companies do, and by doing so, would avoid the red tape that comes with the public procurement code's requirements and the expense and time of dealing with protests.
But Mr. Osterkamp, if you could address the jurisdictional issue raised by the Board of Water Supply related to the 10% requirement in the statute, and how it is that you believe your client has satisfied that requirement.
Sure. So under HRS 103D-709D2, in order for a party to proceed to a administrative hearing following a bid protest, there needs to be a matter, that's an undefined term, that equals or exceeds 10% of the estimated value of the contract, which is also essentially coterminous with the bid price. Now, if that statute were to be in any way equivalent to the actual goals and underwriting purposes of the procurement code, that statute would need to allow for an agency not only to determine responsiveness and responsibility, but to have accountability for that determination. We have had in the past a couple of hearings officers who have interpreted 103D-709D2 to mean that the matter in issues of supposed non-responsiveness relates only to the particular item that arguably makes the bidder's bid non-responsive. That, we would submit, is clear error. Because, in fact, if any portion of a bid is deemed to be non-responsive, the entire bid is thrown out.
Yeah, but wouldn't that render the statutory language basically meaningless? It'd be useless at that point. How do you address that?
Your Honor, I would disagree that it would be meaningless.
Every contract after that would then be in play.
Yeah, so keep in mind that under the procurement code, there are both invitations for bids and requests for proposals. In the RFP context, a matter could easily arise that was less than 10%, would affect the scoring of the request for proposals, and thus would not permit for the offeror, the disappointed offeror, to proceed. In addition, when 103D-709D2 was enacted, we had routinely had agencies apply the Hawaii products preference, and that would permit a bidder to receive a 5% discount on its price if it met certain requirements. So 103D-709D2 could be deemed to apply to that very easily and not permit competing bidders to allege that the product's preference was violated.
Go ahead.
You make an argument, I believe, in your briefs between a offensive and defensive use or challenge to a bid. So if I understand what that argument is, if the bid itself is disqualified, even if it's a relatively small amount of money at stake, which here I think is about $7,000, that's enough to meet the 10% limit, or that the entire value of the contract goes to the 10% limit. But if it were you challenging the successful bidder, then it would have to be a matter greater than 10%. That's a distinction I think you try to draw. And criticism from the Board of Water Supply is, where does it say that in the statute? So I guess that'd be my question to you. Where does that come from, if indeed that is your position?
Well, in this particular case, the issue is whether a bidder that has been deemed non-responsive for a minor issue by the agency can contest that not only in a bid protest, but in a subsequent administrative hearing. And so the issue just before your honors today is whether whether a bidder in that situation that has been deemed non-responsive can contest that. And absolutely, we believe that it would be an absurdity not to permit that. Because if, among other things, a bidder were deemed to be non-responsive for some very major reason, exceeding 10% of its bid price, it would have the ability to go forward. And yet,
the ability to what?
It would have the ability to go forward with not only with a protest, but to an administrative hearing. But if we have a matter that is just of a very small amount, is issued where supposedly a bidder failed to name a very small subcontractor, as you say, one that maybe bid $7,000 or $8,000 on a big project, then in that situation, the bidder would not have a remedy.
So the language, I think the argument is the language of the statute is quite sweeping, and where do you find support in the statute for your position that this could not apply or should not apply to a disqualification of a bid as opposed to a challenge to another, the successful bidder?
Well, I think that, the word matter, given that it is not defined, should be deemed to be the entirety of a bid that is arguably non-responsive. So it would actually apply both offensively and defensively. So if a bidder is deemed to be non-responsive for a large or a small issue, the actual matter at hand is the entire bid price, not just a portion of it, because that's what we're dealing with.
You know, I mean, it seems like, you know, any lowest bidder who's, you know, thinks that they've been wronged, you know, we should have or we would have got the contract absent the disqualification. Mm-hmm. I mean, in a sense, that protest would always be geared towards the entire contract. You know, you're putting 100% of the contract in play, and I think that's what your argument is. But, I mean, as Justice Devin says, doesn't that make the 10% requirement meaningless?
Well, I don't think that it would be meaningless because there are other situations where responsiveness and responsibility are not actually at issue. We can't know what exactly it is the legislature intended when it enacted 103D.
Well, it seems like the policy might have been to streamline the procurement process and avoid challenges that are manini to get the shovels in the ground and get going.
Well, that may have been part of the purpose. But what that means is that the agency then has absolute discretion over virtually any challenge going forward without any oversight by a protester that wants to take something to an administrative hearing. Because the vast majority, and we see this in the record, the vast majority of line items in the bid in this case, certainly, are for amounts that are less than 10%. So it would permit a agency to deem a bid non-responsive for any one of a number of things and have no oversight over that going forward. A bidder could literally lose.
Yeah, I understand that, but then what does the 10% requirement mean then? I mean, you have, let's say yours is 1.59% or even less if you're just counting Cohen at the 6,800.
Yeah.
I mean, that's well below the 10% requirement. And I guess what I'm trying to understand is what your view of the 10% requirement is. What does it mean then?
Well, my view is that it applies primarily to the Hawaii products preference because that was enacted at roughly the same time, and that the products preference allowed for bids to be adjusted upward or downward by small amounts of money. The legislature didn't want the preference to be used as a basis to stall projects in their tracks, didn't want people to take them to hearings and then go to court. Recently, the product's preference hasn't been very much of a factor, but that was, I believe, the intention of the act to begin with.
Can you point to any legislative history to support that? I didn't see anything in your briefing on that front.
Yeah, I agree it was not in the briefing, but we can point to the actual legislation on a rebuttal. I'll provide that.
How do you read together consistently subsection A and D of this statute? I think that's the crux for me.
Yeah, so to start, since the overriding purpose of the procurement code is to make sure that bidders are only awarded contracts when they're responsive and responsible, and that they are not prevented from receiving projects when they're responsive and responsible, that must be our starting point. With respect to Section A specifically, you know, of course, a hearings office only has the authority to review determinations of the chief procurement officer. 103D 709A gives the hearings officer that right. And when we get down to 103D 709D2, it effectively takes away a large portion of that right. So,
well, we're reviewing the ICA's opinion, right?
Yes.
And the ICA, I think that as I read the opinion, it's saying that under subsection A, that your client was aggrieved because Bailiff failed to submit a joint venture notice. So it was a non-response. So you were using it offensively, I guess, or there's an offensive challenge.
Yes.
The 10% issue comes up because of the tree trimming part of the your bid, right?
Well, it comes up both because of the tree removal part of the bid and the tree trimming part.
Okay.
Yes.
So I guess my question is, can A apply to provide jurisdiction as to a part of the challenge, but D preclude part of the challenge that you have raised?
No, I don't believe so, because the... again, we're talking about a matter that is at issue under 103D 709D2, and the matter in this case is both the responsiveness of Alpha's bid and the responsiveness of Bailiff's bid. So you're talking 100% in each case. But even if you were not talking 100% of Alpha's bid, you would be talking 100% of Bailiff's bid, since that was the challenge that Alpha made, was to Bailiff being responsive for failure to submit a required JV form along with the bid.
That may be like a separate issue. I mean, I guess that's my question. Can that be viewed as a separate challenge under A that would provide jurisdiction because your clients are aggrieved? The questions posed to you by the other justices are, if you always view any challenge like your tree trimming, you know, issue that only involves under the percentage under D, how can that always be the whole? You know, that you are writing that part of the statute out of the picture.
Well, I don't think that it would always be the whole because, again, we have many solicitations that are RFPs, requests for proposals, rather than IFPs. And RFPs don't even depend on responsiveness as a concept. So the statute would certainly apply in that context. And we do have some contacts even in the IFB world, including, again, the Hawaii Products Preference, whereby a small issue could get in the way, despite the fact that neither responsiveness nor responsibility is at issue.
What is it that you're protesting here? You're protesting the finding that you didn't have the correct license and the non-disclosure of the subcontractor, Cohen, right?
Correct.
Okay, and you're taking a position that's worth less than 1% of the value of the contract?
Yeah, so there are two portions to that. The there's a line item in this solicitation entitled tree removal and tree trimming. The tree removal portion of that, for which Alpha was licensed, but for which BWS incorrectly deemed Alpha not to be licensed, is roughly 1.5% of the bid price. The tree trimming portion of that line item is only $7,000 or $8,000, and it's less than 0.2%.
Right. So you're trying to get it under the 1%, so you can get it within the discretion of BWS to waive
correct
that discrepancy. Correct.
The tree trimming portion is, of course, under 1%.
Right.
The tree removal part is not.
Right. But then to pursue the appeal, you have to have that 10% of the value of the entire contract. So on one side, you're saying it's only less than 1%, but now you're saying it's more than 10%.
Right.
How do you reconcile that? Because the rule talks in terms of the total value of the contract, mm-hmm. and then the protest concerns a matter that is a percentage of the total value.
Right. So at the
So the percentage that you're talking about is the missing license or the non-disclosure, which is less than 1%.
So at the protest stage and at the administrative hearing stage, Alpha was also contesting the entirety of BEJV's bid. Because BEJV failed to submit a required form with its bid attesting to its status as a new joint venture. And so the claims were aggregated, and the hearings officer found that the fact that Alpha was contesting both of those put it above the 10%, if that is even deemed to be in BWS's word, a matter that doesn't rise to the entire level of Alpha's bid.
Do you disagree or contest in any way that the C-27 license allows you to do more than what the C-17 license allows you to do?
So C-27 and C-17 licenses...
There's two different licenses there. So
right.
The C-27 allow you to do more or to fulfill the contract where the C-17 does not, in terms of tree trimming or whatever the specifics are?
Yeah, so there are a couple of details on that. C-17 and C-27 or C-27B, as the hearings officer noted, do overlap some. C-17 is for excavating and includes tree removal, as the contractor license board found. C-27 and
the C-17 include tree trimming, because there seems to be a distinction between tree removal and tree trimming.
Correct.
Two different activities.
Correct. The C-17 license does not include tree trimming.
Okay, and the solicitation called for a C-27 license. I assume that your client read the HRS. They know that all subcontractors have to be disclosed, and they read what license is required. What legal authority can you point to that would allow you to change or amend that solicitation, which is basically what you're asking BWS to do?
Well,
but you're saying accept the C-17 in place of the C-27.
Yeah, so I would respectfully disagree that the solicitation specifically called for a C-27/C-27B license to be used for tree removal work. So if we look at special provision 29.8B.
I mean, in the exhibit I have, there's an addendum number 2, and it specifically asks for a contractor with a valid C-27 or C-27B license.
So I believe that reads, prior to removal or trimming up trees by a contractor with a valid C-27/C-27B license.
Correct. That's what I'm reading from.
A bird nest survey will be conducted by a biologist provided by BWS. So first off, the word "or" separates tree removal on the one hand from trimming of trees by a contractor with a valid C27B license on the other hand. It does not expressly state that tree removal is to be performed with a C27 license. Alpha did engage a C27 subcontractor for the tree trimming portion.
It just didn't identify the subcontractor.
Correct. That's correct, yes.
Did the bid in anywhere or the solicitation ask for specifically a C17 license?
No, it did not. But the bid or the solicitation did make clear that when a license is required, it used the word shall. So if we go to well drilling work, for example, that's DACA 28, sixth page, and that may not be in front of you, but it reads that the well drilling work, quote, shall be done by a contractor holding a current C57 well contractor license. And at DACA 28, 80th page, special provisions SP 31, again uses the word shall. And even in special provision 29.8, which you have in front of you, Your Honor, that section repeatedly uses the word shall 13 times for activities that are required. But when it comes to the C27B license issue, the word shall is not there. So, yes, I understand that it has been said that a C27B license was required for the tree removal work, but respectfully, I don't believe that the solicitation supports that.
So you're saying that whether it's be at EWS or other agencies, they never use this type of language to require a specific type of contractor, that they always use shall?
Certainly in this solicitation, they always use the word shall. I mean, I'm not equipped to make a sweeping statement about every solicitation, but I can tell you that I have never seen one that required a license that doesn't use the word shall or equivalently mandatory language.
I want to take a step back. My understanding is the first issue was that no subcontractor was identified for tree removal or trimming. Is that right?
Correct.
All right.
Because Alpha has a C17 license, which the Contractors License Board specifically stated is sufficient to perform the tree removal portion of the tree removal and tree trimming portion.
All right. So you're saying that this language is not enough, and because the Contractors License Board says that generically says that C17 allows tree removal, a C27 is not required.
Correct. And it's important to keep in mind here that when the Board of Water Supply rejected Alpha's bid and when it denied Alpha's protest, it did so on the basis that as a matter of law, in a general sense, a C-17 license is not sufficient to perform tree removal work.
Why wouldn't an agency be able to make that determination that they want to have someone with a higher level of expertise in a certain specific type of situation? I mean, I can't really think of a good example, but I was thinking, wow, what if the agency, for some reason, was soliciting certain types of surgeons and said, you know, we want a specialist surgeon, not a general surgeon. You're saying, well, a general surgeon can do the surgery, so therefore the agency can't require the specialist surgeon.
Yeah. I am not saying that an agency cannot do that. I'm saying the agency did not do that here.
Because you're now, so that's based on this language.
It's based on that language, but also the fact that when push came to shove and the agency was trying to defend itself prior to everything getting into, you know, very detailed legal arguments at the hearing stage, the agency defended itself by saying, among other things, actually, that the Contractors License Board had consistently ruled that only a C-27 or C-27B license is sufficient to perform tree removal work, even though just a few days previously, the Contractors License Board had told BWS, the very opposite.
But the hearings officer did find that this language in the solicitation did require a C-27.
Well, it's difficult to tell. The language of the decision is ambiguous, but one of the things that the hearings officer definitely determined was that a C-17 licensee can perform tree removal work. And frankly, that is what is at issue. Under 103D-709I, the hearings officer has the authority to review the determinations of the chief procurement officer. And here, the determinations of the chief procurement officer were that Alpha could not perform the tree removal work because, as a matter of law, in a general sense, the C-17 license does not permit that. It did not make the argument that this language in this licitation or anything specific in the solicitation required a C-27 license. That didn't come up until the hearing after all the lawyers were involved. BWS found that at some point, but it was a pretextual post hoc argument, not an argument that actually went to its decision at the time.
Was the contract, the solicitation notice relatively clear that tree trimming was going to be part of the overall work as opposed to tree removal? Because I understand those are two separate activities that require two different licenses.
Yeah,
is that's correct understanding?
That is correct, that they are two separate activities with two separate licenses. It was a line item, tree removal and tree trimming.
Did you understand or did your client understand the work to involve tree trimming as opposed
yes.
to tree removal?
The client understood that both tree
All right,
removal
so
and tree
with
trimming.
That, the only way you can do that is with a C-27 license.
The only way that the tree trimming could be done was with a C-27 or C-27B license, which it did engage a subcontractor for that.
In that section we talked about a little earlier, it was talking about when the biologist gets involved with the bird survey and so on.
Right.
And the preference to that is prior to the removal or the trimming of trees by a contractor with a valid C-27 or C-27 Bravo license.
Right.
That's the context, right?
That's the context, yeah.
Isn't that relatively clear that you have to have a C-27?
For the tree trimming, but not for the
tree removal. Which is part of the contract, part of the work that was being asked to be done.
Yes, the work that was being asked to be done was tree removal work and tree trimming work with a valid C-27.
And did Cohen have that C-27 license?
Alpha's subcontractor Cohen has that license, correct. So
Thank
that
you.
Is why Alpha engaged Cohen for that work.
Mr. Camp, we're over your time at the moment, so I think at this point we'll move to Mr. Stewart, unless there's anything else you want to raise now, or I'll give you a little bit of time for rebuttal.
That'd be great. Thank you, Your Honor.
All right.
Mr. Chief Justice, Associate Justices, may it please the court, my name is Joe Stewart. I'm here on behalf of the Board of Water Supply. As a preliminary matter, I would like to thank you. This is always a privilege to be able to appear before this court, so I thank you once again for the opportunity. I guess I'd like to start with the Board of Water Supply appeal or petition for cert and note a couple of key points I think that may have gotten lost in the discussion, which are necessarily, the 10% requirement was intended to reduce the number of protests. That seems like an axiomatic point. That to reduce the number of protests, inherently, some people would be left without a remedy. Because if everybody who sought a remedy was able to get one, there would be no reduction over the number of protests. The point is to reduce the number of protests and to take away the close calls to disincentivize people to file protests on small issues, as well as to reduce the burden on the administrative hearings office, which is understaffed as all too many of our administrative agencies are. Secondly, the only time that you would have a protest is if it changed the outcome. We also know this is true. The outcome, nobody protests when they're the awarded bidder That's never going to happen. It's only going to happen if somebody says it should have been me instead of them, whether it's because of improperly applied Hawaii products preference, whether it's because of a situation where somebody was using a preference from a skilled workers training, which is also another type of preference, or whether somebody was saying they should have been deemed responsive or not responsive. Necessarily, they all will result in a change from one awarded bidder to the other. The argument that we're hearing from Alpha essentially is that if it results in such a change, then it involves the matter of the entirety of the contract. Well, I mean, that sort of makes sense, I guess, in a way, on a superficial way. But again, it totally writes out the 10% requirement from the statute, because it would be involved in every single protest, because no protest would be filed if it wasn't changing one bidder to another.
I think they're arguing that the BWS's position leaves them with no remedy whatsoever if it is, 10% and you can't protest. I'm just wondering, what if it's a situation that is like a repeat situation, and it's like there's a lot of contracts, a lot of bids going out, and there's a real dispute between an agency and a contractor regarding what the applicable law is, how the law applies. I'm wondering, if we were to rule that, agree with you that this is jurisdictional and they don't have jurisdiction to challenge this under these circumstances, do you think that this would be comparable to the Alakaina Keiki versus Matayoshi situation in which we ruled that there always has to be a power of judicial review, and the appropriate mechanism in that situation it was a 103F, and there was no appeal from the human services contract. But we said that the appropriate, even though that statute doesn't allow an appeal, and that would be comparable to here if we were to rule that this is jurisdictional and they don't get to appeal because they don't have jurisdiction, the remedy is a 632-1 deck action to get a determination on the law. I assume you haven't really looked at this issue and considered it, or have you?
Well, I have an argument for it. So I guess I'd like to start, if I may, addressing the first statement in your question, which is that it would leave them with no remedy. I would argue that's not the case. They had the remedy of filing a protest. What the statute says is you do not get the remedy of then going to the Office of Administrative Hearing. So there is a remedy. It's just not the remedy that
But it's
seeking.
Not an effective protest, right? Because they can't get a different. If there's a determination that because it's not 10%.
Right. And I think that has to mean something. And the only thing it can mean is that some people do not get a remedy. That's the only thing the legislature could mean. Because otherwise, if everybody got a protest, then there would essentially be no meaning to the 10%.
But what if we were to agree with them on the merits, but we say that because the statute doesn't allow it, there's no jurisdiction?
I think that would be the intent of eliminating protests over small issues.
So you're saying that there is no jurisdiction whatsoever?
And if I
not may, even a 632-1 deck action for repeat players that might want a determination on the law on a specific issue.
As to the 632 deck action, I believe that the 103D provision of exclusivity of remedies would come into play.
Right,
at that
but
point.
It, when you read that language, it says it's exclusive means available for persons aggrieved in connection with the solicitation or award of a contract. So what if the argument was that, there's subsequent that this issue keeps arising and that they need a legal determination on this issue.
So,
I'm just wondering.
Yeah, and just to understand the hypothetical here is that there are a series of repeated contracts where always the issue is under 10%.
Right, right.
And it's the same parties
same,
every single
same
time.
Same parties, or it might be different agencies, but they keep having these issues, the same issue arising, and there's a difference on the interpretation of the law.
I can't speak
you
for
haven't
the,
looked, you haven't
I can't speak for the okay. legislature. All I can say is, to my mind, the 10% requirement effectively requires the lack of a remedy, if you will, to lack of the ability to proceed further in the process.
And basically you're saying no judicial review?
That seems to be what the legislature, I'm saying that's what the legislature says.
That's what 103F said.
Right.
No judicial review. And we said, no, that violates the separation of powers. There's always has to be some mechanism for judicial review.
Yeah. And there is. We're here today.
We're not reviewing. If we agree with you, we're not reviewing the merits.
So, and that's certainly, obviously, at the discretion of the court. I guess my argument would be that if otherwise, there would be no meaning to it, the 10% requirement.
Mr. Stewart, what about the argument that it would apply to a offensive use or an offensive challenge to the winning bidder as opposed to a challenge that the person who or the party whose bid was disqualified, in this case, Alpha. So Alpha, their argument, at least in the briefing, was we should have an unfettered right to challenge our disqualification, but the 10% could apply to their challenge to the winning bidder.
I don't see any real support for that interpretation, but additionally, I don't see where that wouldn't still be the same point that they were talking about. And I think that's really one point that I think is very important to get clear is when we talk about using it in an offensive stance, so in the sense a second low bidder decides to challenge low bidder, you're still only doing that if there's going to be a change of bidder. So the low bidder loses their award, in theory, if that protest is successful. And I think under the same argument that I'm hearing, they would say that the low bidder would then still have the right to appeal such a decision because it would be all or nothing, essentially. And that's the argument that they're effectively making, is that always when you lose your bid, it's all or nothing because you no longer have the low bid. Well, I don't agree with that. I just want to be clear that I think that that's the problem with that, the fallacy of that argument.
You know, this statute talks about, this is in D, 103D 709, little subsection D, talks about bidder, offeror, contractor, or person that is a party to a protest of a solicitation or award of a contract under these different provisions. Is someone who is disputing the fact that they were found to be non-responsive protesting a solicitation or an award?
Yes, they're protesting the award to the responsive person.
But in this case, weren't there two appeals? They protested their own disqualification and they protested, and I'm so sorry, I don't want to mispronounce the name.
BEJV.
BEJs.
JV. BEJV. Right?
There were two. They had two things. You shouldn't have disqualified us over this licensing issue, and you should have disqualified them because they didn't disclose their joint venture. So if you're looking at this language, you're saying, I'm protesting the award to the joint venture, but that 10% would come into play there. But as to whether I'm a qualified bidder or not, I get a chance to litigate. What's your response to that? And again, especially the plain language of the statute.
Yeah, I don't think that that would be consistent with the language of the statute or the intent of the 10%. However, in this case, if you're not challenging, you don't get to challenge the BEJV protest that unless you are responsive. And if you are responsive, you're the low bidder if you're Alpha. So the BEJV protest was essentially a red herring. It never comes up, practically speaking, right? Because if Alpha wins on its issue of the fact that it was improperly determined not to have listed the subcontractor, then it's the low bidder. BEJV's proposal, it does not matter at that point. If it loses, it's not an aggrieved bidder and therefore has no ability to challenge whether or not BEJV was responsive or not. So that's one of the reasons that we think that the bundling of those two together effectively should not have been done, because you really never get to the BEJV protest in Alpha's situation. Either they are the low bidder because they've prevailed on their non-responsiveness issue, or they're a non-responsive bidder, in which case they don't have the ability to challenge BEJV. So at no point do you really need to get to the merits of the BEJV from their perspective, which is why we think that bundling of the two for calculation purposes, does not make sense. There's other reasons why that does not make sense, including the language of the 10% talks about the language of the contract, or the bid, rather. In this case, if you're talking about two different bids, you got two different bid amounts, you know. So I don't think that's what's intended by the language that the legislature added. Some other points that I think we'd like to make are that we do believe it's jurisdictional and not standing based, but nonetheless, we would appreciate the court's clarification because even since the time that this was briefed, there have been two different protests that I'm aware of involving Alpha where this 10% issue has come up and where this the ICA's decision has been cited. So this is an issue that gets brought up a lot. I think it would benefit from clarity, even if it was confirming the standing issue. In regard to the merits of it, we've talked about that to some extent. I think that the word that the ICA used in terms of its standing of prudential standing is potentially problematic in the sense that when we talk about a court having prudential jurisdiction, we talk about some discretion. And I don't think that's what's intended for a state agency such as the Office of Administrative Hearing. So we would disagree with that point.
So it's not a question of waiver necessarily by BWS here. It's the fact that the hearings officer would have discretion whether to move forward and determine there was sufficient standing or otherwise.
So
it's not a waiver issue.
Well, there is a potential argument of waiver, and I guess, I mean, maybe I can only describe my reaction to reading the ICA's decision as far as why we felt the need. Obviously, you know, we're generally in agreement with the hearing officer's decision, with the circuit court, with the ICA, of course. And, you know, I never want to be a sore winner, so to speak. But the reason that the Board of Water Supply thought it was important to address the ICA's decision, because if it had clearly said we find this to be standing and we're not addressing the merits, I think we would have understood, okay, so that's fine. The hearing officer decision stands on its own. The circuit court didn't address it. If the ICA wasn't addressing it for that reason, that it wasn't separately appealed and it's standing, then that's fine. The ICA decision then proceeds to somewhat address the merits of the issue of the calculation of 10%, but I personally found it to be somewhat ambiguous. And so our thought process was that it could be difficult for practitioners going forward to understand how it fits in the big picture. So that was why we moved for clarification on the ICA. And the ICA said, hey, that's not a new argument. And that's understandable. But why we also are seeking some kind of clarification from this court, because I think it does come up. Now, obviously, ambiguity as to the law has always been very helpful to us lawyers in terms of continued employment, but I don't think it's helpful to agencies and parties that are trying to figure these issues out. And so that's why I think clarity would be appropriate. And if it was simple as saying, we find it to be standing and not jurisdictional, the board didn't affirmatively appeal to the circuit court and it was waived from that point, the hearings officer's decision stands unchallenged, that's fine. That clarification would be fine. And I think it would be helpful because then we would know what role to use the ICA decision as a precedent.
I mean, you know, I on the standing jurisdiction issue, in reading your brief and sort of trying to understand it, as I see it, you know, Hawaii courts have limited jurisdiction, you know, federal courts, I mean, have general jurisdiction, federal courts have limited jurisdiction, administrative hearings limited jurisdiction. And I guess I'm just wondering, and I think I know what your answer is, but I'd like you to sort of back it up to a certain extent, is do administrative hearings officers have sort of the same prudential flexibility over standing that courts do? Because that seems to be a big possible shift here.
I would agree. And I, you know, while I wouldn't claim to have the entire body of Hawaii law committed to memory, I'm not aware of allowing administrative agencies to have that type of discretion as far as the prudential standing standard, which is one of the reasons that we sought clarification from this court, because I do think that would be somewhat of a change. Usually administrative agencies have, you know, setting aside like Chevron deference and all those kind of issues, of course, on the federal level, administrative agencies do usually have statutory creation and limited authority. And if you're allowed to do those things and sort of, you know, make your own decisions, if you will, it seems like that would be inconsistent with what's intended.
And if there was sort of this, I guess let's call it prudential flexibility, would that collide with the statutory requirement of 10%?
Certainly, because you wouldn't be bound by it, right? You'd be free to make a decision that, for whatever reason, we think this is sufficiently important. Or in theory, you know, courts, federal courts, certainly, when they use their prudential standing, say, we choose not to address these issues for various reasons. And so could the hearing officer actually exceed the 10% and say, because of the size of this bid, 10% is not that much? Or, you know, I mean, I don't know what the flexibility could lead to, but I do think that there's some significant risk of allowing the hearing officers to make it up.
Well, could the flexibility lead to, you know, a bid that's, let's say, disqualified at 9.9%? You know, hey, look, we're going to disqualify you, but, you know, we'll let you into the game.
It would seem like that would be on the table. In if the concept that the administrative hearings office of administrative hearings rather has prudential standing flexibility,
or if you're at 1.59%, hey, it's okay. Yeah. We're just gonna do any kind and let you in. I mean, so that's sort of the difference between jurisdiction and standing here at these matters, right?
Correct.
And that's one reason why you've appealed this case.
Yes, that's correct, Your Honor. So. I guess I'd like to switch to the substance of the Alpha appeal, unless there's any other questions regarding the...
Sorry, I want to go back one more time. So why do you reject the distinction between having the ability to challenge the disqualification of a bid as opposed to trying to attack the other bid? Doesn't it seem, again, I'm not sure you directly answered my question. The statute refers to solicitation or award. So award implies to me challenging the award of the contract to someone else. Solicitation, I think, is talking about the process. So is there not a different category or some different categories of protests that aren't covered by this 10%? I guess that's my question. And would one of them be a protest of a bidder's disqualification?
I'm not aware of any case in Hawaii which has made that argument that there's a third category in terms of determinations of non-responsiveness. There is a separate process for non-responsibility, and that involves going directly to the Office of Administrative Hearings. So it has always been interpreted by the Office of Administrative Hearings and in every other decision that I'm aware of that a determination of non-responsiveness is subject to a 701 protest. So it would be subject to that same criteria, which then leads you to the 709 appeal. So I'm not aware of that. That would be, to my knowledge, at least a brand new formulation of the law. Okay, so as to the substance of the Alpha appeal, I think it's always helpful to start at the beginning. The Board of Water Supply issued an RFP. The RFP provided that one of the bid items was to be tree removal and trimming. That's one of the specific delineated bid items. The RFP also stated, as Justice Devens had previously quoted, that there would be an expectation of a removal or trimming to be done by a contractor with a valid C-27 to C-27B license. I think it's important then to say, well, let's look at what the Contractor Licensing Board says in regard to the C-27B license. It's called tree trimming and removal, exactly the same words. It says that it's to prune, trim, and remove trees, including stumps, and restore ground to conditions similar to adjacent area. So when the Board of Water Supply received the original Alpha bid, there was no C-27B or C-27 contractor listed.
Well, why shouldn't the Chief Engineer Law's May 17th letter be construed as an after-the-fact waiver of having to list Cohen as a subcontractor because it was less than 1%?
I don't believe that it would be a waiver for two reasons. One, I don't think that you could prospectively waive based on the circumstances that you didn't know about at the time. And at the time of that letter, there was no knowledge of the failure to list Cohen. it was, as far as the Board of Water Supply knew, there was nobody that had been retained.
But it wouldn't matter, because they said you don't have to list them anyway. So why would knowledge be relevant?
I don't think that that would change the law. The law still requires, under 103D302, the listing of all subcontractors. There was no reliance on that by Alpha, because Alpha had already submitted its proposal, which did not include Cohen. So there would be no waiver, because there's no reasonable reliance upon that. There's no estoppel conduct there, because there was no action that Alpha took following that letter that they said they could reasonably say, hey, I relied upon what Mr. Lau said. They had already made the choice not to list Cohen. And you've heard today, they acknowledge that a C-27 license was required at least for the tree trimming provision portion of that item. So they knew that a C-27 license was required for a portion, at least. I'll get to whether I agree with the removal portion, but we've heard them admit that C-27 license was required, and we know for a fact that prior to that letter that Mr. Lau sent, they had chosen not to list a C-27 licensee. So that's the information the board has at that point. So only at the protest stage does suddenly this concept of Cohen come into play. Cohen is not listed up until that point. So now the board has to address two issues, and they're the two issues that are before you in the Alpha appeal today, which are, was the failure to list Cohen, was that a failure in violation of 103D302? And then the sub-question of that is, was it waived by the Board of Water Supply? And separately, there's the portion of the tree trimming and removal line item that was not going to be covered by the Cohen proposal. Right, the Cohen proposal is 7% of the total bid item here. So we're talking a very small amount. And this is supposed to be ostensibly for tree trimming and removal, that they're saying that, you know, this, our subcontractor is only going to do 7% of that. Now, looking at the protest, obviously, you know
it seems de minimis, the deviation. And why wasn't it in BWS's best interest to just simply have waived that discrepancy, because it would have saved some money, maybe not a whole lot, but there was something to have been saved between the two bids.
Well, and I was just about to get there, and so thank you for that. I would respectfully disagree with counsel that it is clear at all that a C-17 licensee can perform what's contemplated by the tree trimming and removal work in the Board of Water Supply. Not only were all bidders specifically put on notice that the board expected a C-27 license, so that was one thing. But even in terms of, if we just look at whether they can, there's been some citation to an email from an unnamed member of the Contractor Licensing Board, which says throughout, do not take this as anything official. There's two Contractor Licensing Board decisions where related issues come up and they find that a C-17 has some authority. There's also two Contractor Licensing Board decisions where they say, no, a C-27 is required for tree trimming and removal. At best, that's ambiguous. So what I would say is, let's look at the law, right? Those are decisions that are made on the facts of those cases. They're not on the facts of this case. But what we do know is that the Contractor Licensing Board and the DCCA propounds administrative rules. The administrative rules include these contractor licensing categories. They make these decisions. There's an A license, a B license, and then a whole series of C licenses. The A license includes a number of C licenses automatically. And so Alpha, as an A licensee, has all of those licenses that are deemed by the Contractor Licensing Board to be included. And we see another example of that in the C-27B license, right? The C-27B license is the one that says tree trimming and removal. But the Contractor Licensing Board says anybody who has a C-27 license automatically has a C-27B license. What it doesn't say is none of the A licensees automatically have a C-27 or a C-27B license. Had they so chosen to make that determination, they could have, right? Because there's lots of C licenses that are automatically included in the A license. This one's not. I apologize if I butchered the Latin, but expressio unius est exclusio alterius, right? A list is a list.
You have to presume that if they chose to do something and chose not to do something else, that there was meaning associated with both actions. So what we have is a situation where neither a C-17 licensee nor an A licensee is deemed to automatically have a C-27 or a C-27B license. We've seen the language of what C-27B says. It's clearly directly on point on both tree trimming and removal. If there was a decision, an official decision, having larger applicability, then the administrative rules could have made that decision, but they didn't. So here's the question, if you're the Board of Water Supply. You're sitting there now with, at best, a murky record from the Contractor Licensing Board. There's no official position on these facts. There's an ad hoc email that says, don't rely on this. The prior Contractor Licensing Board minutes have situations which are going back and forth. You told bidders in advance, we expect this to be a C-27, C-27B. Do you want the Board of Water Supply to be making aggressive calls in terms of licensing? I would submit no. The purpose of contractor licensing laws is to make sure that only people who are qualified are doing the work. The Board of Water Supply told them who they thought was qualified to do this work.
Council, what is the status of this project? Was it completed?
It is not completed. It's still underway.
But it did start. This proceeding has not held it up.
No. Once the stay ended at the hearing officer decision level, it proceeded. So it's the contract is executed. The work is undergoing. So getting back to my point on the contractor licensing, if the Board of Water Supply were to say, hey, we think that a C-17 license may be able to, so we're just going to go ahead and award, is that the power that the Board of Water Supply has? No, I don't think so. I don't think they can make gray area calls. And especially, do they want to when they've told everybody in advance that they expected a C-27? No, they don't. And I don't think we want them to. I think we want them to be conservative, because the whole purpose of contractor licensing laws is that to get licensed contractors to do the things they're good at and that they're experts in. And in this case, using a C-17 license where you take a big bulldozer and you just, you know, take a whole field down is way different than removing trees that are next to buildings, right? Those are dangerous. That's why we have specialists. That's why the C-27B license exists. And that's why the Board of Water Supply told its bidders that it expected a C-27 or C-27B licensee to be doing this work. And that's why, had Alpha questioned that or challenged it, the time for that challenge would have been before it submitted its bid. To challenge the content of a solicitation at this point is untimely under 701. So,
but Alpha seemed to understand that because they had somebody lined up. Right? Isn't that the
They record? Had somebody lined up for 7% of their total tree
trimming. Right, but what a C-27 license. They had somebody lined up.
To do a very, very small portion of the $95,000 that they were going to use for just tree trimming and removal. That's what that bid item says. And they did have somebody lined up for 7% of it, but didn't have anybody lined up for the remaining 93%. And so to answer your question, and I apologize, it was a very long-winded answer perhaps, the reason that the Board of Water Supply didn't exercise discretion is that it didn't feel that it was appropriate to allow somebody to intentionally withhold identifying the contractor, subcontractor that had been identified in the solicitation, that it didn't feel that it was appropriate to say to a contractor with a C-17, it's okay to self-perform the 93% of the tree trimming and removal that was going to be done by Cohen with your C-17 license, when the C-27 license was specifically identified by us in advance in the solicitation, and when the C-27B license explicitly describes the work that's going to be performed. So, you know, I think that's more than adequate justification not to exercise discretion. And as you say, the dollar cost between the two proposals is pretty de minimis in terms of the scope. So nothing further.
Thank you very much, Mr. Stewart.
Thank you.
Appreciate your argument. Brief rebuttal, Mr. Osterkamp.
Thank you. So I want to very briefly provide the site that I promised earlier. This is the legislative history of 103D 709D2. So we look at 2009 Senate Committee Report 1207. It's in the Senate Journal at 1427 to 28. Among other things, it is stated that the legislation was passed in order to require a dismissal of protests for inadvertent errors of less than a specified amount of the bid amount of the competing bidder. And in the same act, it clarifies the definition of Hawaii products and products qualifying for preferences. So I believe that the context of that is clear. The legislature was not trying to attack the ability to hold agencies accountable on responsiveness and responsibility issues. It wasn't taking that out of the procurement code. It wasn't gutting the procurement code, which is essentially what we would be talking about here if all of a sudden an agency would never be held accountable for making a mistake on responsiveness or responsibility, as long as that line item that's being interpreted is less than 10%. But I want to also touch briefly on the sequence of events that Mr. Stewart was explaining to us regarding the Board of Water Supply's actions. I think this is crucial. As we know, at some point, the Board of Water Supply decided that Alpha's bid was non-responsive for failure to list a C-27 or C-27B licensee. And it's clear why that happened, because as Mr. Stewart said, the C-27B license is named tree removal and tree trimming. An assumption was made. May 13th, 2022, BWS goes to the competing bidder, BEJV, tells the competing bidder that they're going to get the contract. 4 days later, Alpha is advised of that fact. Alpha didn't know at the time that BWS went to BEJV. Very next day, May 18th, 2022, Alpha submits a protest. It shows BWS that it was wrong about the non-responsiveness determination. It attached the contractor license board minutes, which, by the way, are from 2018 and were the most recent word on the subject. The previous minutes were not contradictory, but in, I believe, 2013 and 2011, in very project-specific contexts, the contractor license board had...
Does a C-17 allow tree trimming?
A C-17 does not allow tree trimming. It allows tree removal.
Thank you. Yeah,
could you wrap up at this point,
yeah.
Mr. Oster?
Yeah, so
final point.
We have the contractor, we have the Board of Water Supply making these decisions in a vacuum without knowing what the real context is. It goes to the contractor license board, asks for ammunition to defeat the protest. The CLB says the opposite. It was not an unnamed officer, by the way. It was the executive officer, Candace Ito, of the Contractor License Board, who responded, made very clear what the Contractor License Board's perspective is on this, both from her speaking to other people at the CLB and the most recent meeting minutes on that issue. The Board of Water Supply could have asked for a formal opinion. It decided not to. It didn't like the answer it was given, and so it proceeded down the road of determining that Alpha's bid was non-responsive. It then made a false statement in the rejection of Alpha's protest, and away we went.
All right. Thank you very much for your argument. Thank you to both of our counsel for your arguments today. The court will take this matter under advisement.
Thank you.
Iku Iluna, please rise.
Ua ho'omalolo ia mai ne kea aha ho'o kolokolo ki'i ke'i hanaharo. This Honorable Supreme Court is now recessed.